Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for December's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, RCVS specialist in small animal surgery, Mark Morton. Thank you, Mark. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in for this webinar. Apologies, it's slightly delayed this month. What we're going to talk about today is managing hip dysplasia. We're going to particularly focus on the young patient. It's a bit of a broad topic to cover it all in detail, and perhaps we can look at sort of how we might manage hip dysplasia and osteoarthritis in adult dogs in a webinar in the future. So what we're going to talk about today, we're going to have a little bit of a recap on hip dysplasia, what it is. We're going to talk about how we can diagnose it and what we can do about it. So what are the conservative and surgical management options for these younger dogs? So alongside that, we'll have a bit of a conversation about when we should intervene with these cases as well. Here's a sort of classic X-ray showing a dog with hip dysplasia. And secondary osteoarthritis in the right side there, something that you'll all be familiar with and seeing on a regular basis. It's just a bit of a recap on the hip and the anatomy of the hip. So we all know that the hip is a ball and socket joint, the ball being the femoral head and the socket being the acetabulum, which is part of the pelvis. The acetabulum develops from the fusion of the ilium, the ischium and the pubis. A normal fusion occurs by about 6 months, but that can be affected by the breed and diet and early neutering. So it's not unusual to see the growth plate between the ilium and the ischium in the center of the acetabulum up to about 6 months of age, and that, of course, should not be mistaken for a fracture. The acetabulum is deepened by a band of fibrocartilage. The acetabular rim. Eventually, it becomes the transverse acetabular ligament as it crosses the acetabular notch. The femoral head is held into the acetabulum by the ligament of the femoral head, the round ligament or the Teres ligament, as it was called. That runs from a fovea in the head of the femur to the acetabular fossa. So hip dysplasia is a bit of an umbrella term, really. We use it to talk about young patients that sort of truly have hip dysplasia, but it's a term that we all use when we're talking about those older dogs as well, that have ended up with arthritis secondary to having hip dysplasia as a youngster. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with Vet Compass, but it's one of the surveillance tools that links into certain practice management systems. And from clinical notes, they can pull out data on how common conditions are. This is their summary on musculoskeletal disease. And you can see per 1,000 animals, there's about 7 cases of hip dysplasia reported. However, lots of these other cases of osteoarthritis and arthritis and lameness probably relate to hip dysplasia as well. It's a particularly prevalent condition. The best definition of hip dysplasia that I've come across is this from Olson. Hip dysplasia is a disease that stems from a varying degree of laxity in the hip joint that allows subluxation of the femoral head in early life. It gives rise to a varying degree of shallowing of the acetabulum, flattening of the femoral head, and inevitably leads to osteoarthritis. And I think that's a really good summary of what we're talking about. So dogs are born with normal hips, and how they develop over about the first 60 days, or the first 60 days is the most critical with respect to development of hip dysplasia. And we think the underlying cause is a progressive laxity. What causes the laxity? Well, there's a big genetic component to that. Heritability has been estimated somewhere between 20 and 60%. And we all know that certain breeds are predisposed. On top of that, genetic predisposition, environmental factors will influence the expression of hip dysplasia. So things like nutrition, growth rate, exercise, There's some theories that look at the volume of synovial fluid. So if you have an increased volume of synovial fluid, does that permit more laxity? So sort of swelling of the joint capsule. It's quite possible that that's a secondary effect of inflammation caused by laxity. And things that other people talk about, so changes in this, rather than it being sort of primary bony change, is issues with the soft tissue. So does the degree of muscle mass permit laxity? Is it different amounts of collagen in the ligaments and the joint capsule, etc.? And is that one of the reasons why we see variation between breeds? For example, very muscular greyhounds, it's really uncommon to see hip dysplasia. So a little diagram of the normal hip. So we can see there the femoral head, how it sits into the acetabulum, and it's held in place with the joint capsule. And you can see the round ligament there as well. You can see that that's a nice congruent joint, a nice round femoral head, and a nice deep acetabulum that fits well with the femoral head. Really, the reason for showing the first diagram is to just show you this one in contrast and how we think the lax hip develops. So you can see there the femoral head is sitting out from the acetabulum. Round ligament has become elongated. The joint capsule is a bit more slack. There's less tension there. And that joint is starting to become less congruent. What we think happens in the development of hip dysplasia is that somewhere between 2 and 3 months of age, you get this progressive laxity. You start to get some rounding of the labrum, abnormal wear of the cartilage, malformation of the femoral head, and the round ligament begins to swell. Often at this stage, these dogs aren't particularly painful. As progressive laxity develops, you start to get some dorsolateral subluxation of the femoral head, and the femoral head starts to contact the acetabular rim. And what tends to happen is that you get lots of little microfractures in the acetabular rim that become painful and uncomfortable, and that's when these dogs start to develop lameness. Because of that laxity, underloading, that femoral head contacts the acetabular rim, and there's a reduced contact zone there that can also start to affect the cartilage on the femoral head. Between 5 to 9 months of age, the laxity progresses. You begin to get these microfractures. You can start to get tearing of the joint capsule. The body's response to this is to produce osteophytes to try and stabilize the joint. And then as we've said, at this stage, you start to get damage to the cartilage. This is when these dogs really are painful. You can see here on a sort of 3D representation how those changes correlate to the X-ray on the right side. So you can see with this patient here, there's marked subluxation of both femoral heads. In this VD extended position, sort of position that we commonly assess dogs in for hip dysplasia, the joint capsule femoral tension, and that should in theory pull the femoral heads further in. So if you're still seeing significant subluxation of the femoral heads like that on a VD extended view, there is significant laxity there. Between 10 to 12 months of age, we might start to see an improvement. So as the muscle bulk catches up with the bony development, the laxity starts to reduce or be a bit more controlled. The musculature around the hip pulls the femoral head back into position, or into a more normal position. You start to get healing of those microfractures. Thickening of the joint capsule helps with stability. This can result in a restricted range of motion. Sometimes that can be a true restriction. Sometimes it can be dogs that are guarding their hip because they're painful. But generally, we'll start to see a bit of an improvement. The problem is that what you've now got is a femoral head that doesn't quite match up with the acetabulum because they weren't growing in unison. You often have a flattened femoral head and a shallow acetabulum, and the two sides start to wear against each other. You begin to get cartilage loss and the inevitable progression to osteoarthritis. That fits with this classic biphasic presentation of hip dysplasia that we talk about. And you can see here the progression of pain over time. So this first hump, if you will, is those younger dogs between sort of 5 and 10, 12 months of age that are painful because of the laxity and the micropatches that develop. And then we generally, in most dogs, start to see some improvement. And that varies massively depending on the severity of the disease. But as muscle bulk increases, those dogs will become more comfortable as a general rule. And then, as we've said, as osteoarthritis progresses, lameness and discomfort becomes more apparent. And we're probably dealing with two separate problems. Well, we are dealing with two separate problems, hip dysplasia and osteoarthritis, as a consequence of the hip dysplasia, but we're all guilty of still using hip dysplasia for young and old patients. This sort of brings into the some of the conservative management things that we'll talk about later, because one of the aims of conservative management is to try and get over that first blip as quickly as possible. So the benefits of building up muscle bulk as early as possible is to reduce that laxity, try and stabilize the hip and make the dog more comfortable earlier on. We can't do anything to affect the conformation of the femoral head or the acetabulum at that stage, so arthritis may well progress. But if we can get dogs more comfortable in the short to medium term, that's certainly a positive. One of the questions we should always be asking is, are we dealing with hip dysplasia? It's often easy to presume in young dogs of particular breeds, Labradors, German Shepherds, etc., etc., that the hip dysplasia is the cause. This was an interesting study out of Washington University, looking at a population of dogs that had cruciate ruptures. All these dogs actually were presented for assessment with a diagnosis of hip dysplasia. So there's 370 dogs nearly that were presented, and 32% of those dogs were actually because they had a cruciate rupture rather than hip dysplasia. 94% of those dogs did have radiographic evidence of hip dysplasia. 92% had a stifler fusion and 81% had a cranial draw. So it's really important to check it is hip dysplasia and not presume, and that's the reason for some of the diagnostics we'll discuss. The other thing, probably more common in older patients with sort of arthritis, but it's always important to try and differentiate between hip dysplasia and lumbar sacral pain. So when you extend the coxofemoral joint, it gets to a point where the femur will go no further. And what happens is that the whole pelvis starts to tip. And what you're actually doing is extending the lumbar sacral joint. So it's really important to test the hip and the lumbar sacral joint in isolation. It's difficult to test when you get to that point, full extension, to not affect the lumbar sacral joint. So what I would do is then test the lumbar sacral joint on its own without extending the hip. The way to do that is to put your arm sort of underneath the abdomen and pelvis of the dog, and then sort of lift the pelvis up and then push down on the lumbar spine to sort of extend the LS joint without manipulating the hip. Here's an example of what, well, it's a myelogram showing what happens when you extend the lumbar sacral joint. And you can see the compression of the corner of the corda equina on the lower view. As you extend the lumbar sacral joint, you can see that contrast column being pushed out of the way. How do these young dogs present? Well, a familiar story that the owners report. They're slow to get up. They quite often have a narrow-based gait. They look like they're walking along a tightrope. In bilateral disease, bunny hoppings are a really commonly reported sign. these patients tend to have a reduced swing phase of the gait, so they don't fully extend the hip backwards. They tend to get some of the way, and then rather than extending fully, they circumduct their limb to the side. In bilaterally affected patients, they can have a low head carriage as they try and shift their weight forward onto the thoracic limbs. They have a shortened gait and stance because of the reduced extension of the hips. And some of these dogs can stand with quite upright hocks. We call it muscle wastage, but it's probably under development of musculature at this age. But that will result in dogs having prominent trochanters. In some really clinically affected dogs, you can feel the femoral head subluxating on conscious examination. And often, if these dogs are painful, they simply won't let you extend their hips. So, visually, you can see here this Labrador has a very narrow base. Stance, it has some muscle atrophy, and you can see this upright position of the hocks. We see some patients referred every year for assessment of, usually young patients referred for assessment of a problem with their hocks because of this stance or gait that turns out actually to be as a result of hip dysplasia. And we think the cause of this is a reluctance to extend the hips because they're painful. So these dogs tend to stand with their femur in a slightly flexed position, which shortens the limb overall. They then stand with their hocks in sort of full extension to try and compensate for that. So they have this really upright position. Examination-wise, we talked about the clinical examination, but one of the most important things to do, if there's any doubt, is to assess these dogs under sedation or anesthesia. I think most dogs you can assess them under sedation rather than needing to be anaesthetized, and equally I'll quite commonly perform radiographic assessment under sedation rather than a general anaesthetic. We'll all be familiar with the Ortolani test. You lie the dog on its back, apply some sort of femurs pointing upwards, and abduct the limb to the side. The Ortolani sign is that clunk that you feel as you abduct the hip, and that clunk is the femoral head reducing back into the acetabulum. The sort of second part of that test is the Barlow test. As you adduct the hip, so back towards midline, you'll feel the femoral head subluxate again out of the acetabulum. Sometimes really severely affected dogs don't have a very convincing Ortolani sign or Barlow sign because the acetabulum is so shallow, the femoral head just sort of slides on and off rather than that nice clunk we'll all be familiar with. It's really important before you check for the Ortolani sign to get the hips central and to apply some downward pressure, because the Ortolani sign is the reduction part of this test, so pushing downwards first subluxates the femoral head. Just showing you that sort of in a diagram form, the Ortolani test on the left, so moving the hip from a midline position, abducting out to the side, that clunk is the reduction. And then the Barlow test, the sort of second part of that, bringing the femur back towards midline, adducting it, and that's the femoral head luxating again. Historically, we like to measure the angles of reduction and subluxation for planning procedures like triple pelvic osteotomy, for example. I very rarely do that, to be honest. So, from a radiographic assessment point of view, the most common view that we'll take is the VD extended. For that, you want the dog on its back, both femur parallel, the patellae dorsally positioned. As we said earlier, that causes spiral tensioning of the joint capsule and will actually reduce subluxated hips a little. So they may appear better than they are. We also take a lateral pelvis. I think that is more valuable in older dogs where you might be looking for other pathology on the lumbar spine, for example, or assessing the neoplasia. There's a view called the dorsal acetabular rim view, which Barclay Slocum made popular. It's not something that I do. Believe it's rarely used amongst colleagues. And the pen hip technique, we'll talk about that in a moment, is a distraction method to try and have a look at how much laxity is there. And the basis behind that is what we talked about earlier. So on that VD extended view, you're actually improving the conformation of some hips secondary to that spiral tensioning of the joint capsule. So pen hip is a distraction method that pushes the femoral heads out of the acetabulum if there is laxity present. From a hip scoring or assessment point of view, we won't talk too much about this, but there's various hip schemes around the world. In the UK, we have the BVA, sorry, Kennel Club scheme. There's the OFA scheme in the States, and pen hip is actually a screening technique as well. Pre-breeding, you can assess a score in adult dogs to decide whether you should breed from them or not. In the UK, the BVA Kennel Club scheme is subjective and objective features to that. It assesses the laxity, subluxation of the femoral heads, the Nordberg angle, and the presence and severity of osteoarthritis in various areas. Each side is assessed individually with a maximum score of 53 per side. One of the criticisms or the problems with the scheme is that submission is voluntary. I'm sure there's lots of dogs that have X-rays taken for assessment that aren't then sent in for scoring because the advice is that they won't get a very good score and it's sort of a waste of money. Of the X-rays that are sent in for assessment, the BVA publish median score for each breed that you can look up on their website. They do that sort of for every dog that's been assessed and also a rolling 5 year to look at trends and improvements So when should we assess these dogs? Well, there's a few timescales when you might want to assess them. So the obvious one is when you're presented in a consultation with a dog that's clinically affected, sorry. So they're lame, the owners report reduced exercise tolerance, sitting down a lot, whatever it may be. If we're planning treatments or interventions, so if there was a suspicion of hip dysplasia, we're thinking about doing something to try and slow down its progression. And the final thing that we've touched on is for breeding. So the hip scoring scheme to assess adult dogs as and their breeding potential, the likelihood of them passing on hip dysplasia. The timing of that is pretty crucial. So there was a study in the 70s where Jessen and Spurrell looked at dogs over a number of years and repeated radiographic assessment on a VD extended view to see how hip dysplasia progressed. The final evaluation was at 5 years and there was no new cases of hip dysplasia at that stage. So, of the dogs that developed hip dysplasia ultimately, on their X-rays that were taken at 6 months, between 16 and 32% were diagnosed. At 1 year, between 60 and 70% were diagnosed. And at 2 years, up to 95% were diagnosed. So, in the States, the OFA hip scoring scheme, the minimum age for dogs to be assessed for a score on there to detect for hip dysplasia is 2 years. And we can see up to 95% of dogs will be picked up at that case at that age. With the BVA Kennel Club scheme, you can assess dogs for breeding from a year of age. So there is a minimum error there if you look at this paper of 30%. So there will be some dogs that will get a good hip score at a year that may still go on to develop hip dysplasia, but they've already been given the okay for breeding, and that's probably one of the faults of the system. So we use the BD extended view, as we said, to assess hips. So it evaluates laxity. So here you can see both femoral heads are subluxated. It assesses the Norberg angle, which is the angle from the center of the femoral head to the craniodorsal acetabular rim. A Norberg angle of less than 105 degrees is considered abnormal. There are some breed defined angles that you can look up, and they vary slightly, but 105 is a good starting point. We talked about pen hip, and this is a sort of dynamic test to assess the level of laxity. You get a score from that. That score is linear. So we'll talk about that in a second. There's a couple of views you take. So the first view here is what's called the compression view, and that's to assess the maximal seating of the femoral head. So one of the things we see in some dogs is infilling of the acetabulum with soft tissue, early new bone formation. So you can see how well the femoral head seats. The second part of it is the distraction view. So you use this specially designed device that you stick between each femur, then sort of use that as a fulcrum, squeezing both femur against it to test how much laxity is there. So on the X-ray there, you can just about see the device on the sides of the X-ray, and you can see both femoral heads have subluxated. And that X-ray is the same dog that's in the previous one where we assessed maximal seating. So you can see the difference distraction makes to that. One of the problems with pen hip is radiation safety laws in the United Kingdom. So you can see in this picture here, assistants here are holding the distraction device in place, and they're also holding both femur against that distraction device as we take the X-ray to assess the level of laxity. Now you can't do that in the UK. Mike Gilliard did a study to try and validate a non-holding technique. It involves lots of tape and strings and so on and so forth. But he demonstrated that it was possible to get a pen hip score and comply with radiation safety laws. And his paper in practice describes how to do that with pen hip X-rays. When you've taken the X-rays, you send them across to the pen hip scheme, and they score them for you. The way the distraction index is calculated, so on the distraction view, you draw a circle of best fit within the acetabulum. You find the center of the femoral head. You measure the distance between the center of the acetabulum and the center of the femoral head. And you divide the distance between the center of the acetabulum and the center of the femoral head by the radius of the femoral head, as you can see on that diagram. A distraction index of less than 0.3 should not result in the development of hip dysplasia or osteoarthritis. Some dog breeds require tighter hips than others, and conservative management is unlikely to be successful if you've got a distraction index of higher than 0.7. It's a linear score, so a point, a score of 0.7 would mean 70% of the femoral head is subluxated. 0.3 would be 30%. So an example here, of a dog that was assessed for hip dysplasia. Question would be, does this dog have hip dysplasia on this sort of normal VD extended X-ray? So you can see there the compression view, looking at maximal seating of the femoral head and checking for acetabular infilling. And then finally, the pen hip view. So on that first X-ray, you'd probably say the hips didn't look too bad, but you can see the significant amount of laxity that's there. Now, if you're not doing pen hip scoring, you may take that VD extended view and then assess the hips for laxity manually by checking for an autoline sign. So it doesn't mean that if you're not doing pen hip, you're going to necessarily miss these cases. But pen hip allows you to see how much laxity is there and give them a score which may affect the prognosis of treatment options that are available. So you can CT hips for assessment as well. We don't do that too commonly unless we're doing them, we're CTing the dog for another reason. But that's a 3D reconstruction of a dog with hip dysplasia. CT is pretty helpful if you're thinking about procedures such as juvenile pubic symphysidesis or pelvic osteotomies, because one of the things that you can do before and after surgery is assess on some of the slices the angle of the acetabulum, the acetabular angle, and see how that improves following your surgical procedure. And I'll show you an example of that shortly. This is the same dog from 6 months of age to 3 years. This is how he progressed. So you can see at 6 months of age, there was significant subluxation of both femoral heads. This dog was treated conservatively. By 10 months of age, both femoral heads were luxated. There was significant infilling of the acetabulum on both sides. And by 3 years of age, there is what we'd all recognize as significant osteoarthritis in both hips. What we don't do, in the older arthritic dogs is judge how badly affected they are or talk about treatment decisions based purely on radiographs, because some of these dogs can actually be so bad that they, well, the hips can be so bad that they cope okay. If you've got pretty much no effect of acetabulum and the femoral head's just sort of sliding around on a saucer rather than sitting in a cup, some of these dogs can cope reasonably well and be pretty comfortable. The worst looking X-rays don't always correspond to the most severely affected patients. Just a quick video I want to show you here. I just sort of tried to various times to make videos like this myself, but this really is an excellent video that I can't compete with. It's produced by BVA and Kennel Club health scheme for hip dysplasia, and they show you how to perfectly position a dog for hip radiographs. So there's a couple of little tips that I'd sort of share with you if we can start the video, please. Someone showing this that I need to do. The video is playing, I'm actually playing, so oh, I can't. So it's easy, the video playing, to sort of keep up with you and give you commentary on this. So what I would suggest is that if you go to the BVA, website, you can see this video with the key really for the positioning the video playthrough anyway, but I hear the commentary you can do at later. I can't see where we're up to on the video. The best thing to do is that if you go to that video and watch it, they describe sort of how to position the dog and so on and so forth. For me, it's using Sander's positioning aids and so on. And they also talk about how to the webinar, if you go to the video. Good commentary on there. So we'll move on to the next slide. So hopefully we're back on the presentation now. So there's conservative and surgical options for these youngsters. The key here is that we're in the young dogs, we are treating hip dysplasia or trying to treat hip dysplasia rather than the osteoarthritis that we see in the older dogs. And our aims may be difficult, or sorry, may be different. The aims of these younger dogs are to reduce the laxity in the hip joints as quickly as possible. We do that by increasing muscle bulk. Hopefully, that minimizes the pain and discomfort that those dogs are in at that stage, enables them to get back to exercise a little bit quicker. It may slow down the progression of osteoarthritis and may mean that they can avoid a surgical intervention. We generally see an improvement with these dogs between 12 and 15 months of age anyway. The joints don't suddenly become normal, but they may well have no lameness. So again, as we said before, the worst looking x-rays don't correspond to the most clinically affected dogs. We would encourage these dogs to do some exercise, though not too much. It needs to be done in a controlled fashion. We want to keep them as fit as possible. We want to build up as much bulk as we can. There are diets that may be effective, things like JD, the use of joint supplements and things. A lot of these dogs are also going to require pain relief to keep them comfortable while we try and get them over that sort of first blip, and let them do some exercise to build up that muscle. From a rehab point of view, swimming or hydrotherapy is really good. Treadmill is so much better than just sort of free swimming. Hydrotherapy is, of course, non-weight bearing exercise, or with a treadmill, partially weight bearing exercise. But by varying the depth of the water, you can sort of control how much weight those dogs are taking through the hip joint. Treadmill hydrotherapy, if you've never seen a dog doing it, is really, really hard work. It's very difficult to walk against the resistance of the water, and these dogs tend to build up muscle quite quickly. If hydrotherapy on a treadmill is not an option, you can get a similar effect by walking dogs sort of through the shallows, either as the sea comes in or through down a riverbank, against the resistance of water there, or even walking sort of through long grass can have a similar effect. Lead walking, we'd advise little and often. There's lots of, I'll call it advice about how much you should exercise a dog, depending how many minutes you should do, depending on how many weeks or months of age it is. I found sort of no basis in the literature for that advice. So as a general rule, we'd advise short and often, no more than sort of 15, 20 minutes on the lead. Cold packing ex after exercise can be beneficial. That should be done for no more than 15 minutes. An ice pack should be wrapped up in a towel. Each dog's going to be a bit different here. So what you don't want to do is to exercise a dog so much it ends up in discomfort. So I would encourage owners to keep that level of exercise to no more than 15, 20 minutes, three, four times a day on the lead. But if the dog can't cope with that much to start with, there's no need to push them, do what they're comfortable with. We know that excessive exercise is contraindicated in young dogs. We've protected the identity of our friend here, but we all know the importance of weight control. We see plenty of dogs, even at this young stage, that are overweight. Maintenance of a lean body weight is really important. The aim at this stage is to delay or prevent the progression of osteoarthritis. There's some really good studies that look at the benefits of this. So Gail Smith's group have published a number of studies. This is probably the sort of best of those from a discussion point of view, where they had a cohort of dogs, littermates, that were split into two groups. Some were, had a restricted diet, and some were allowed to eat whatever they wanted. The restricted fed dogs had a lower prevalence and a later onset of hip osteoarthritis. They weighed on average 26% less than the dogs that were fed ad libitum. Not only did they have less prevalence of osteoarthritis, but the mean age, or the median age, sorry, identification radiographically of hip osteoarthritis was 6 years in the restricted fed dogs compared to 12 years in the dogs that were fed ad libitum. And at the end of the study, 83% of the dogs that were fed whatever they want had arthritis compared to only 50% of the dogs on a restricted diet. So does conservative management work? Well, there's been a few studies on this with conflicting results. In the 80s, this study by Barr looked at the long-term results of conservative management. They had 50 dogs with clinical and radiographic signs of hip dysplasia that was diagnosed at less than 1 year of age. Those dogs were treated with restricted activity only. At the point of reassessment, three quarters of those dogs had no or intermittent lameness, and 70% were exercised normally by owner assessment. There had, however, been a radiographic progression of osteoarthritis in nearly 90% of those dogs. So again, this sort of comes back to two things: that firstly, that the dogs that are radiographically the worst are not always the dogs that are clinically the worst, and also sort of brings in a bit of a question about how well owners can assess how well their dogs are doing. There was another study here that looked at the results of conservative management when compared to femoral head and neck excision and triple pelvic osteotomy for treating hip dysplasia in young dogs. There was only 20 dogs. They showed that that dogs with a triple pelvic osteotomy did best. The conservatively managed dogs didn't do so well compared to the excision or the osteotomy dogs. Sorry, assessment was subjective. It was not a blinded study. And the main aim of the study was to assess the effect of surgery. So there wasn't a big focus on conservative management, if you will. The conservative group really was not treated surgically rather than doing things like dietary control, physio, rehab, hydrotherapy, etc., etc. So it doesn't invalidate conservative treatment. Mike Farrell published a more recent study looking at how well conservatively managed or non-surgically managed dogs with hip dysplasia did over time. There were 74 dogs in this study that were assessed by urine questionnaires that looked at pain, lameness, exercise, any analgesics. 30% of the dogs in the study were reassessed by a vet. Most dogs were affected in 9 out of the 11 outcome measures that they looked at. A significantly higher proportion of these dogs were needing treatment than has previously been reported. So we're on some sort of analgesic. 40% of them, however, did have other orthopedic conditions, and there may have been some comorbidities that were affecting the answers to these questionnaires. This paper is a systematic review. So a systematic review or a meta-analysis looks at other studies that have been published and tries to draw a conclusion from the literature as a whole, if that makes sense. They found 14 papers that assess conservative management, looking at activity restriction, weight loss, acupuncture, the use of nutraceuticals, physio, rehab. The conclusion from this study was that weight management and weight sort of control is effective as part of a management strategy for hip dysplasia in juvenile dogs. However, further studies were required to assess the effects of physio and rehab. And that's certainly an emerging area in orthopedics. What are the surgical options for these patients? So for hip dysplasia as a whole, we tend to split the surgeries into surgeries that we can do in the juvenile patients, the immature patients, and procedures that we can do in the more mature dogs. So for the immature patients, we've got juvenile pubic symphysiodesis or JPS, and then the pelvic osteotomies where you can either make three cuts or two cuts. The sort of mature dogs that are past the point of those possible interventions, we have the salvage procedures of total hip replacement and femoral head and neck excision. Now, of course, both those procedures, salvage procedures, the hip replacement and the femoral head and neck excision are appropriate for juvenile dogs as well that are severely affected. We can do hip replacements from about 9 months of age. How do all these sort of surgeries fit together from a time point of view? Well, at two at the top, the arthroplasty, the dorsal acetabular rim arthroplasty, where you try and increase coverage of the femoral head and the neurectomy, so a denervation of the hip to try and make dogs more comfortable. They're not very commonly performed. Arthroplasty you can do up to about 8, 9 months of age, and the neurectomy you can do at any point, but not many people do those now. Conservative management is always an option and is probably something that should be done on an ongoing basis for any patient diagnosed with hip dysplasia. We can do total hip replacement from about 9 months of age. Femoral head and neck excision, the sort of lower limit to that normally is the point of diagnosis, so 4, 5, 6 months of age. You can do that from any point. Triple pelvic osteotomy, we can do up to about 10 months of age. And juvenile pubic symphysiodesis, sort of 16, 20 weeks, depending on the breed. So the surgical procedures we have at our disposal for immature patients try and improve femoral head coverage. And that's JPS and the triple or double pelvic osteotomies. What we're aiming to do is provide more acetabular coverage to the femoral head by rotating the pelvis outwards. So JPS was originally a surgery that they developed in a colony of experimental guinea pigs. The idea is that by closing the pubic physis prematurely, the pelvis grows outwards, whilst the rest, well, the pelvis grows outwards, but it doesn't affect the sort of the growth of the pelvis as a whole, and it results in rotation of the acetabula over the femoral head. Ideally, you do this surgery between 12 and 16 weeks of age. It's significantly less expensive, invasive than pelvic osteotomies. Quite a lot of dogs are affected bilaterally because you're treating the symphysis in the middle of the pelvis. This surgery theoretically treats both sides, whereas a pelvic osteotomy, you would have to perform surgery on both sides, if that makes sense. JPS does not reduce laxity, and it hasn't been shown to reliably prevent the progression of osteoarthritis. One of the things with JPS, actually, with pelvic osteotomies, less so if there's implants still present, is that it can be difficult to detect in patients if this surgery is successful and lameness resolves. What you have is a with the genetic basis of hip dysplasia is a genotypically abnormal dog appearing phenotypically normal. So really, we should neuter these dogs at the time of surgery to ensure they're taken out of the breeding pool. As we said, it's a bilateral surgery. It's minimally invasive. One of the problems is there's a very short window of diagnosis, so you need to treat these dogs ideally at 16 weeks of age. We can't predict the long-term outcome, so we don't know how these dogs would do when we're diagnosing, how these dogs do without any treatment when we're diagnosing them at such a young age. Laxity still remains, and this surgery relies on the growth of the dog. So here's what we do. So the pubic symphysis in the middle of the pelvis there, have the dog on its back and make a small approach to that, and destroy that symphysis with cautery. When we talked about CT scans for assessment of hip dysplasia early on, so here's one of the things that it's useful for. So on the left of this slide, this is measuring what we call the acetabular angle. You can see it's relatively poor coverage of the femoral head there. You can see the pubic symphysis in the middle of the pelvis at the bottom of the slide. On the right, you can see a repeated CT scan done, I think, 3 months later. You can see the symphysis in the middle of the pelvis has now closed. And you can see that both sides of the pelvis have rotated outwards. The acetabular angle has increased significantly, and there is more coverage to the femoral head. But the CT scan there sort of gives you an idea that there's still some laxity present. So looking at the studies around JPS, first study here showed that the incidence of OA at 2 years was much less in dogs that were treated with JPS compared to dogs that weren't. They got better results at 15 weeks than 20 weeks. The study at the bottom here from Aldo Bazzoni showed that JPS increased the odds of limiting progression of hip dysplasia. It had no effect after 22 weeks of age. And the dogs that did best, unsurprisingly, that were the ones that were mildly affected. There's no difference in how these cases do when they're very severely affected with significant laxity or incongruity. And that's probably because when you've got significant laxity and subluxation of the femoral head, you can rotate the acetabulum, but if the femoral head sat so far away from it, you simply won't get capture of it. So pelvic osteotomies, classically we talk about a triple pelvic osteotomy, but we'll see in a second that people are doing this probably do more double pelvic osteotomies, so two cuts rather than three. You can perform this procedure up to 10 months of age. It's a unilateral surgery, so in bilaterally affected dogs, you need to do this on both sides. The aim of the procedure is to isolate the acetabular segment and rotate it laterally. So similar to JPS, But instead of relying on the remaining growth of the dog, you physically rotate that acetabular segment outwards and fix it in position with a plate, a specially designed plate and screws, with the aim of increasing femoral head coverage. Again, this does nothing to address the laxity that may be there. So we make three cuts in the pelvis. So at the top, initial cut, in the middle, a cut in the ileal wing behind the sacrum in front of the acetabulum. And we also make a cut or remove some bone from the pubis as well. And we rotate that acetabular segment outwards. As we said, we can do this up to, from a patient selection point of view, the younger the better. It's been shown to have an effect up to about 10 months of age. Again, we have an issue with how much laxity is there. So you want to be sure that you've diagnosed hip dysplasia, but if you've got significant laxity and significant subluxation of the femoral head, you simply won't get capture of the femoral head when you rotate the acetabulum outwards. Really, there should be no evidence of osteoarthritis at the stage of performing this surgery. No infilling of the acetabulum, a really clean, distinct Ortolani sign to sort of suggest that you're likely to be able to capture the femoral head. And other people have described a significant difference between the angles of reduction and subluxation. A clean dorsal acetabular rim, really sort of relating to no pre-existing osteoarthritic change. This first study that looked at the outcomes of triple pelvic osteotomy, so there's lots of studies that show good limb function post-operatively. This study used force plating to assess how dogs did. So following surgery, there'd been an increase in peak vertical force, so the force that dogs were putting through their leg by 8 weeks, and that force had normalized by 28 weeks. Secondary osteoarthritis does still progress on these dogs. And again, similar to JPS, the dogs that did better are the ones that are least affected. So the younger dogs with less laxity, as they presented it in this case. Radiographically, here's what you do. So the first X-ray there showing hip dysplasia with luxation, subluxation of the femoral head. And in the X-ray on the right, you can see the section of bone that's been removed from the pubis. The acetabular segment has been rotated laterally and fixed in place with a special plate and some screws, improving femoral head coverage. There were some potential issues with this. So, in early studies, there was a significant level of implant failure. So, screw loosening in soft bone. As with any surgical procedure, there's a risk of infection. The bone needs to heal. You can have issues with wound healing, neurological injury, and obstipation from narrowing of the pelvic canal. Again, as we talked about for JPS, ideally these patients should be neutered at the time of surgery. Post-operatively, these dogs need period of really, really strict rest. So cage or one room for 4 weeks, and then a re-examination and some X-rays. And if the bones are beginning to heal at that stage, which it often is in these young patients, then you can start to build up activity from there. In the initial stages after surgery, it's important to stress that the dogs are walking on the implants, if that makes sense, and that's all that's holding it together. And the more they do, the more likely you are to get implant loosening and failure of the procedure. Quite often with screw loosening in that really soft bone in juvenile patients, Koch reported screw loosening in up to 60% of dogs. So again, we've talked about some of these things, but it's important to choose which dogs to do this on. And that's really something that I struggle with. How would these dogs progress without treatment if you're picking them up so early? And again, it's normally the worst dogs that are presenting at this stage that pelvic osteotomies won't benefit. The surgery needs to be performed early. There are the risk of complications with the procedure. We simply don't know how these dogs would do if they were treated conservatively, so it's sometimes difficult to commit them to a big surgical procedure without trialing conservative management first. And we know we need to wait in some of these cases for the natural improvement at sort of 12, 14 months of age, by which stage it's too late to perform pelvic osteotomy. There's always the option of a hip replacement. So if you manage dogs conservatively and they don't do so well, a hip replacement can be done at any stage. Whilst triple pelvic osteotomy doesn't preclude hip replacement at a later date, when you've already had a surgical procedure on your hip, the risk of infection following that is four times higher. There's significant costs with a pelvic osteotomy followed by a hip replacement. And there's also the issues with the complications that we've talked about. So a recent sort of progression in that is the change to a double pelvic osteotomy, so two cuts rather than three. The cut that's removed is the ischial osteotomy. That's been shown to reduce implant failure and the loss of rotation, probably by there being a bit more of a it being a more stable construct. Again, the younger you perform a double pelvic osteotomy, or the younger age of the dogs that you perform a pelvic osteotomy in there. Let me start that again. If you're performing a double pelvic osteotomy, it's much easier. Perform it in younger dogs, so six, seven, easier to rotate that section out with clients. A similar time to the move to locking implants are now commonly used for both double and triple pelvic osteotomies, and that's also reduced the complication rate of around screw loosening, implant failure, and loss of rotation. So the sorts of salvage procedures, so we sort of normally talk about these from head and neck excision and total hip replacement with adult dogs, but we'll just sort of touch on it for these younger patients as well, because it's certainly an option. Young dogs can do very well with femoral head and neck excision. They bounce back quite quickly, and we can do total hip replacement from 9 months of age. So deciding between conservative and surgical management, it's not an easy decision. We quite often don't diagnose these dogs early enough, certainly for JPS. And there's always a question of, are they severely enough affected to warrant a surgical intervention at that stage? Should you treat them conservatively to start off with? And that brings two things into play. One is that if they're really severely affected, that they need surgical intervention at a really young age. Triple pelvic osteotomy or a double pelvic osteotomy is probably not going to help them. From a conservative point of view, that needs to be discussed as an ongoing thing. These dogs are going to need conservative management, weight control, maintaining muscle bulk over the course of their lives, even if you get them over this initial blip. So the other surgeries that we more commonly would discuss with older dogs, but we'll talk about today because we're focusing on the younger patients, is from like head and neck excision and hip replacement, which can be cemented or cementless. So with a femoral head and neck excision, the joint's converted to a pseudoarthrosis. So the idea is that you remove the femoral head and neck, you remove the contact points between the acetabulum and the femoral head that's causing pain and discomfort. And function at that stage relies on the integrity of the soft tissues. Technique for this is essential to a good outcome. You can do femoral head and neck excision in any patient, and there's this loose sort of guideline of 20, 22 kilos that's banded around, that they shouldn't be obese, they should be active, able to do physio afterwards to build up muscle bulk and things. It is a salvage procedure, so you want to rule out sort of other treatment options first. But in a bigger dog that may be overweight or not particularly active, if a dog is so severely affected that you're considering salvage procedures and total hip replacement isn't an option for economic reasons or whatever, I would have no problems in trying a femoral head and neck excision and seeing how well they did. I think the consensus would be that smaller dogs will do better than bigger dogs, but that doesn't rule them out from having the procedure. So indications other than hip dysplasia, things like Perth disease in cats, metaphyseal osteopathy, irreparable or chronic hip fractures, hip dislocations when you've got concurrent hip dysplasia or arthritis, septic arthritis that's resulted in significant cartilage loss, and possibly, as a result of a failed total hip replacement. You can see on the left there that dog is got sort of femoral neck sort of fractures, probably secondary to like Perth's. So here's an example on the left. You can see that the preoperative view. This is a Westie with like Perth's disease. And on the right, you can see postoperatively after a femoral head and neck excision. So a nice cut there, extending from near to the greater trochanter to the lesser trochanter, and all the neck has been removed. Another example here of a good post-operative X-ray. You can see that there's no neck left or any spurs. As we said, sort of technique is vital to this procedure really, to get a good outcome. What you're doing is an osteotomy from the greater trochanter down towards the calcar region, preserving the lesser trochanter. And it's really key that the osteotomy is perpendicular to the long axis of the femur, not to the femoral neck, because the femoral neck is angled. So there is some normal antiversion to the femoral neck. And if you look at these two arrows here, the arrow on the right shows making a cut perpendicular to the femoral neck, where the arrow on the left shows making a cut perpendicular to the long axis of the femur. If you make your cut perpendicular to the femoral neck, what you'll end up with is a spur on the sort of caudal surface there that quite often contacts the acetabulum and causes ongoing pain and discomfort. Just sort of describes it a bit better. So the way to do that sort of clinically is to hold the leg or get your an assistant to hold the leg with the kneecap pointing towards the sky. So the femur is externally rotated. And then what you're aiming to do is make your cut perpendicular to the table or the floor. So not perpendicular to the neck, you're cutting straight downwards. It's really easy to sort of tilt your saw blade to be perpendicular to the neck, but you really need to avoid doing that. Complications we can see. I would advise using an oscillating saw for this procedure. If you're doing it with an osteotome, it's possible to fracture the femur. We sometimes see sciatic neuropraxia, and that's normally as a result of excessive traction of the femur out of the way while you're making your cut, or incorrect placement of retractors, Galbi retractors, for example. And really, that can be avoided with cautious technique. Long term, we may see poor limb use, or persistent lameness. That's often down to poor surgical technique, leaving a bony spur. Not damaging soft tissues or not closing everything up appropriately afterwards. it can result from poor post-op care. So I would advise after this surgery a couple of weeks of really strict rest just to let the soft tissues begin to heal and the surgical incisions to heal. And then really we want to get these dogs going because we want them to build up muscle as quickly as possible and get them using the leg. So here's an example on the left of a poorly executed femoral head and neck excision. So you can see that there remains a spur at the femoral neck, and the function of this patient was not particularly good. And on the right there, following revision, removing all the remainder of the neck, and that resolved the persistent ongoing lameness. So we just touched on this, sorry, but yeah. So a period of strict rest initially, and then starting to build them up afterwards. Hydrotherapy is good again to build up that muscle bulk quickly, and I would advise treadmill rather than just swimming. So how do these dogs do? Well, you know, a lot of what we talk about is anecdotal, but there are a couple of studies that have looked at the outcomes. So this study was originally published in a German journal and then was republished in VCOT a few years ago, looking at how dogs and cats did following excision arthroplasty of the hip. On a veterinary assessment, about 40% of patients were doing well, 20% were doing okay, and 40% were actually doing poorly. However, 96% of owners were satisfied with the results of the procedure. From that point of view, the outcome was very good. Kinetic and kinematic assessments of those dogs showed that whilst the surgery had alleviated discomfort, pain, function of those dogs was not normal. So they can be more comfortable, but they don't return to normal perfect function. So what if you've got bilateral disease? Well, this study showed that bilateral femoral head and neck excision was viable to do, and the dogs coped pretty well and were ambulatory afterwards, and ultimately ended up with normal activity levels and were pain-free and assessed by owners. So femoral head and neck excision is an option for sure as a salvage procedure. I think in small patients for sure, or for, excuse me, patients when total hip replacement isn't an option. Really the gold standard would be to preserve the normal function of the joint with a hip replacement. There are cemented and cementless systems that are commonly used. Historically, we talked about hip replacement as a salvage procedure only, so it would be sort of middle-aged to older dogs that had ended up with significant osteoarthritis that we were doing these procedures in. Because outcomes with hip replacements have improved so much and the systems are now pretty reliable, you know, we don't just sort of do this as a salvage procedure in affected patients from 9 months of old age. We would do this to sort of manage the hip dysplasia before they've developed that secondary arthritis. So we won't sort of talk too much about each of these systems, but just to sort of show you the options. On the left, there's a system called the Helica that sort of screws into the proximal femur and the femoral neck. One of the most commonly used systems at the Universal Hip System by Biomedrics. On the left, there is a cementless system, the BFX cup and stem, that relies long term, short term, sorry, on a sort of press fit, and long term stability is provided by ingrowth onto the stem and the back of the cup. And the cemented system, where the femoral component is cemented in place, as is the acetabular component, and that's the CFX system. And it's possible to do a hybrid of that with a cementless cup and a cemented femoral stem. And on the right there, the Kyon system, which is a cementless system, which has some screw fixation for the femoral component, as you can see there. This is a sort of close-up of the system that I use and I'm most familiar with, the Biomedrics cemented system. So there is a cobalt chrome stem. It's modular, so you can change the sort of femoral head to increase tension and minimize luxation. So here are just a before and after. So on the left, you can see a sort of template how we size these patients, and on the right, the post-operative view showing the femoral component cemented into the femur, and the sort of little metal ring around the outside of the polyethylene cup. Just going to skip over that video as well, which was a sort of animation of how to perform a hip replacement procedure. It's available on the biometrics website if anybody's interested in seeing that. But as I can't talk through it as before, we won't show that. So what system to use? How do you make a choice? Well, there's certainly a big degree of personal preference there. What's available from a surgeon and a kit point of view, so in your area. Outcomes with hip replacements is certainly a big component of how well patients do, is the experience of the surgeon performing that and what they're most familiar with. And there is a little bit of evidence around that. Now, that evidence is important to all vets. Even if you're not performing a total hip replacement, you need to know what systems give the best outcomes so you can choose potentially where to refer cases to, for example. So in 2009, Professor John Innes launched the BVOA, the British Veterinary Orthopaedic Association Hip Registry. A registry is a way to record information about the health status of patients and the care they receive over time. Examples of people would be the National Joint Registry or the National Ligament Registry. And the aims of a registry are to improve sort of feedback to hospitals and surgeons to detect failures with procedures or particular implants or devices, and to look at prognostic factors that might be associated with good and poor outcomes. There's about 1,500 cases on the BVOA hip registry to date. The aim was initially to analyse the outcomes of all hip replacements performed in the UK. There has been some international expansion on that front. Just before we look at the results of the hip registry, I saw a little bit of a plug about another registry that's coming. So in partnership with RCVS Knowledge, we're launching a canine cruciate registry that's open to all veterinary surgeons across the UK performing any surgical technique. We hope we will be able to provide data that will help guide decision making on what procedures to perform. You'll be able to perform your own clinical audit on your own results. The registry will be anonymous, so you'll be able to see your own results and compare them to the mean of the rest of the surgeons in the country, but nobody else will be able to see your results. There's sort of a bit outside this talk today, but if you while we're talking about registries, if you want to register your interest, there's some more information on the website there. We'll keep you updated. The BVOA hip registry, they produced two papers from that. So the most recent one by Lissy Henderson in 2017 showed an overall complication rate that reported about 8%, owners about 4%. But when they looked at different implant types, they did see some problems. So there was greater complications reported with BFX, so the cementless system by biometrics than the cemented system. So you're 4.5 times more likely to have a complication with a cementless system than cemented. And nearly 3 times more likely to have a complication when a hybrid technique's used rather than cemented. Having said that, for more procedures, 95% of owners were satisfied with the outcome. Post-operatively, after a hip replacement, you need really, really strict rest for the first 6 weeks before reassessment and some X-rays, and then a second 6 weeks of sort of controlled activity, so lead walking to improve balance proprioception and begin to build up muscle bulk, and hydrotherapy again, treadmill for me, but swimming as well. We try and keep these dogs to lead activity for a further 8 weeks after that, so up to 4 months in total, while the femur adapts and remodels to having the implants in place. That minimizes the risk of femoral fracture. The more activity dogs do, certainly in the immediate post-operative period of time, the higher the risk of dislocation and femoral fracture. And the dogs may need to, a period to recover or to get comfortable if they're bilaterally affected. So what complications do we see? So as a sort of bit of a sweep across the literature with the cemented system we use here, there are 10% complication rate reported. In the initial post-operative period, dislocation is the most common complication. As we said, the femur needs time to adapt to its new loading. And femoral fracture is a potential risk at the time of surgery, more commonly with cementless systems. Infection is a devastating complication because it requires generally that all the implants are removed and you're left with a very expensive femoral head and neck excision. Aseptic loosening, where the implants loosen without infection being present, again quite often results in an explantation. Sciatic neuropathy is similar to with femoral head and neck excision. It's normally due to retraction of the femur or position of retractors, and it normally improves with time. Sort of acetabular sort of cup wear out is something that we don't worry too much about in dogs, though it's a big worry in people. In people, they'll delay having a hip replacement for as long as possible because they know the lifespan of implants is about 15 years. With the best will in the world, most implants will outlive our patients. So post-operatively in people, they're super strict, so you can't flex your hips more than 90 degrees. You're not allowed to adduct past midline, so you can't cross your legs. You can't bend and touch your toes. Now, some of those things are sort of lesser a problem because you know, some of these patients are people maybe up to 80 years old. The patients we're talking about here today are young, sporty, active dogs that want to leap around. You cannot restrict their activity completely and stop them trying to jump up on their back legs, etc., etc. So the key thing with hip replacements in dogs is that we can't rely on the post-operative period to stabilize our implants. We must be happy that everything is positioned correctly and the implants are stable at the end of surgery. In recent years, the implants have got smaller, so Biomedrics now produce a micro and nano hip system that can go down to small dogs and cats. So whereas historically the only option for those smaller patients was femoral head and neck excision, certainly hip replacements becoming a more realistic option. And you know, there are more complications reported with the smaller systems. But as we gain more experience and techniques evolve, it may be that becomes the recommendation. For smaller patients. Just a sort of brief summary slide of the options that are available before we finish up. Looking at the top here, you've got sort of dogs with hip dysplasia at any age. Do we think medical management's an option? Well, if yes, we sort of have a look at weight loss, anti-inflammatories, and omega-3 rich diet. And if there's a response, we continue that therapy. If there isn't a response, we reassess them again. We think about can we change that medical management? Is there something that we could add in or do differently? And if so, follow that path again and assess the response. If not, the options then depend on whether the dog's immature or mature. You know, what we've talked about today, the younger patients, if they're between sort of 6 and 10 months of age with arthritis that's already developed, then medical management really is the only option until they release reach skeletal maturity, at which point total hip replacement is viable. If they're 6 to 10 months of age, a pelvic osteotomy is an option if they have no arthritis present. And if they're somewhere between 12 and up to 20 weeks of age with a lowish distraction index, then JPS is an option. For once dogs have reached maturity, if they're large and active, hip replacements. If they're small, or there's economic factors, a femoral head and neck incision. Now, those two at the bottom are a bit of a sweeping statement, really, but sort of give you an idea on how we might manage these patients. So, what do I do with these patients? Diagnosing them early, I think, is key, but it's sometimes out of our control, depending on when they're presented by the owners or referred. I'll always try a period of conservative management first if it hasn't been done. I'm quite aggressive with that. So initially, a period of really strict rest and anti-inflammatory up to 4 weeks to sort of allow the joint to settle down, and then really get going with physio and hydrotherapy to improve muscle bulk as much as possible. I very rarely, if ever, do pelvic osteotomies or juvenile pubic symphysiodesis. I think if I saw a dog at 16 weeks of age or younger and was that convincingly had hip dysplasia that wasn't too severe, I would consider JPS, but in my experience, I'm not seeing those dogs young enough. And if dogs are severely enough affected, rather than either of those procedures, I would advise an early hip replacement from 9 months of age onwards. So that's a sort of brief touch on managing hip dysplasia and the options in the younger patients, the sort of conservative and surgical options. I hope that's been helpful. We might have a look at a future date of what we can do in the adult dogs. So again, the touching on the surgical procedures, the hip replacements, and things maybe in a little bit more detail, but also looking at the management from a medical point of view, and other concerns and things that we might consider. Thanks again for tuning in to the webinar. Hope you found it useful.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Mark Morton for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.